He shook his head, but took a moment to get his breath back before replying.
No, he said, in a voice so hoarse I could scarcely hear him. She's still with the goats. I dare say it's warm in there.
I eyed him uneasily. Grave digging is hard work. His shirt was clinging to his body, soaked through in spite of the coldness of the day, and his face was flushed. With labour, I hoped, rather than fever. His fingers were white and as stiff as mine, though. It took a visible effort for him to uncurl them from the handle of the shovel.
"Surely that's deep enough," I said, surveying his work.
I would myself have settled for the shallowest of gouges in the soft earth, but slipshod work was never Jamie's way.
"Do stop, Jamie, and change your shirt at once. You're wringing wet. You'll catch a terrible chill."
He didn't bother arguing, but took up the spade and carefully neatened the corners of the hole, shaping the sides to keep them from crumbling inward. The shadows under the pine trees were growing thick, and the chickens had all gone to roost, feathery blobs perched in the trees like bunches of brown mistletoe. The forest birds had fallen silent too, and the shadow of the house fell long and cold across the new grave. I hugged my elbows and shivered at the quiet. Jamie tossed the shovel onto the ground with a clunk, startling me. He climbed up out of the hole and stood for a minute, eyes closed, swaying with weariness. Then he opened his eyes and smiled tiredly at me.
"Let's finish, then," he said.
Whether the open door had indeed allowed the deceased spirit to flee, or whether it was only that Jamie was with me, I felt no hesitation in entering the house now. The fire had gone out, and the kitchen was cold and dim. Yet there was no sense of anything evil within. It was simply empty. Mr. Beardsley's mortal remains rested peacefully under one of his own trade blankets, mute and still. Empty, too. Mrs. Beardsley had declined to assist with the formalities, or even to enter the house so long as her husband's body remained inside, so I swept the hearth, kindled a new fire, and coaxed it into reluctant life while Jamie took care of the mess in the loft. By the time he came down again, I had turned to the main business at hand. Dead, Beardsley seemed much less grotesque than he had in life. The twisted limbs were relaxed, the air of frantic struggle gone. Jamie had placed a linen towel over the head, though when I peeked beneath it, I could see that there was no gory mess to deal with. Jamie had shot him cleanly through the blind eye, and the ball had not burst the skull. The good eye was closed now, the blackened wound left staring. I laid the towel gently back over the face, its symmetry restored in death. Jamie climbed down the ladder and came quietly to stand behind me, touching my shoulder briefly. "Go and wash," I said, gesturing behind me to the small kettle of water I had hung over the fire to heat. "I'll manage here." He nodded, stripped off his sodden, filthy shirt, and dropped it on the hearth. I listened to the small, homely noises he made as he washed. He coughed now and then, but his breathing sounded somewhat easier than it had outside in the cold.
"I didn't ken it might be that way," he said from behind me. "I thought an apoplexy would kill a man outright."
"Sometimes that's so," I said, a little absently, frowning as I concentrated on the job at hand. "Most often that's the way of it, in fact."
"Aye. I never thought to ask Dougal or Rupert or Jenny whether my father..."
The sentence stopped abruptly, as though he had swallowed it.
"Ah!"
I felt a small jolt of realization in my solar plexus. So that was it. I hadn't remembered, but he had told me of it years before, soon after we were married. His father had seen Jamie flogged at Fort William, and under the shock of it, had suffered an apoplexy and died. Jamie, wounded and ill, had been spirited away from the fort and gone into exile. He hadn't been told of his father's death until weeks later, had no chance of farewell, had been able neither to bury his father nor honour his grave.
"Jenny would have known," I said gently. "She would have told you if..."
If Brian Fraser had suffered a death of such lingering ignominy as this, dwindled and shrunken, powerless before the eyes of the family he had striven to protect.
Would she? If she had nursed her father through incontinence and helplessness? If she'd waited days or weeks, suddenly bereft of both father and brother, left alone to stare death in the face as it approached, moment by slow moment? And yet Jenny Fraser was a very strong woman who had loved her brother dearly. Perhaps she would have sought to shield him, both from guilt and from knowledge. I turned to face him. He was half naked, but clean now, with a fresh shirt from his saddlebag in his hands. He was looking at me, but I saw his eyes slip beyond me to fasten on the corpse with a troubled fascination. "She would have told you," I repeated, striving to infuse my voice with certainty. Jamie drew a deep, painful breath.
"Perhaps
she would," I said more firmly. He nodded, drew another deep breath, and let it out more easily. I realized that the house was not the only thing haunted by Beardsley's death. Jenny held the key of the only door that could be opened for Jamie, though. I understood now why he had wept and had taken such care with the digging of the grave. Not from either shock or charity, let alone from regard for the dead man, but for the sake of Brian Fraser, the father he had neither buried nor mourned. I turned back and drew the edges of the blanket up, folded them snugly over the cleaned and decent remains, and tied it with twine at head and feet, making a tidy, anonymous package. Jamie was 49, the same age at which his father had died. I stole a quick glance at him as he finished dressing. If his father had been such a one as he was, I felt a sudden pang of sorrow for the loss of so much, for strength cut off and love snuffed out, for the loss of a man I knew had been great, only from the reflection I saw of him in his son. Dressed, Jamie circled round the table to help me lift the body. Instead of putting his hands under it, though, he reached across and took my hands in both of his.
"Swear to me, Claire," he said.
His voice was nearly gone with hoarseness. I had to lean close to hear it.
"If it should one day fall to my lot, as it did to my father, then swear you will give me the same mercy I gave this wretched bugger here."
There were fresh blisters on his palms from the digging. I felt the strange softness of them, fluid-filled and shifting as he gripped my hands.
"I'll do what must be done," I whispered back at last, "just as you did."
I squeezed his hands and let them go. "Come now and help me bury him. It's over." Chapter 28. Brownsville. It was mid-afternoon before Roger and the militia reached Brownsville, having missed their road and wandered about in the hills for several hours before meeting two Cherokee who had pointed the way. Brownsville was half a dozen ramshackle huts strewn among the dying brush of a hillside like a handful of rubbish tossed into the weeds. Near the road, if the narrow rut of churned black mud could be dignified by such a word, two cabins leaned tipsily on either side of a slightly larger and more solid-looking building, like drunkards leaning cosily on a sober companion. Rather ironically, this larger building seemed to operate as Brownsville's general store and taproom, judging from the barrels of beer and powder and the stacks of drenched hides that stood in the muddy yard beside it, though to apply either term to it was granting it more dignity than it deserved, too, Roger thought. Still, it was plainly the place to start, if only for the sake of the men with him, who had begun to vibrate like iron filings near a magnet at the sight of the barrels. The yeasty scent of beer floated out like a welcome. He wouldn't say no to a pint either, he thought, waving a hand to signal a halt. It was a numbingly cold day, and a long time since this morning's breakfast. They weren't likely to get anything beyond bread or stew here, but as long as it was hot and washed down with some sort of alcohol, no one would complain.
He slid off his horse and had just turned to call to the others when a hand clutched his arm.
"Attendez."
Fergus spoke softly, barely moving his lips. He was standing beside Roger, looking at something beyond him.
"Do not move."
Roger didn't, nor did any of the men still on their horses. Whatever Fergus saw, so did they.
"What is it?"
Roger asked, keeping his voice low, too.
"Someone, two someones, are pointing guns at us through the window."
"Ah." Roger noted Jamie's good sense in not riding into Brownsville after dark the night before. Evidently he knew something about the suspicious nature of remote places. Moving very slowly, he raised both his hands into the air and jerked his chin at Fergus, who reluctantly did the same, his hook gleaming in the afternoon sun. Still keeping his hands up, Roger turned very slowly. Even knowing what to expect, he felt his stomach contract at the sight of the two long, gleaming barrels protruding from behind the oiled deerskin that covered the window.
"Hello, the house!"
he shouted, with as much authority as could be managed with his hands over his head.
"I'm Captain Roger Mackenzie, in command of a militia company under Colonel James Fraser of Fraser's Ridge."
The only effect of this intelligence was to cause one gun barrel to swivel, centering on Roger, so that he could look straight down the small dark circle of its muzzle. The unwelcome prospect did, though, cause him to realise that the other gun hadn't been trained on him to start with. It had been, and remained, pointing steadily over his right shoulder toward the cluster of men who still sat on their horses behind him, shifting in their saddles and murmuring uneasily. Great. Now what? The men were waiting for him to do something. Moving slowly, he lowered his hands. He was drawing breath to shout again, but before he could speak, a hoarse voice rang out from behind the deerskin.
"I see you, Morton, you bastard!"
This imprecation was accompanied by a significant jerk of the first gun barrel, which turned abruptly from Roger to focus on the same target as the second, presumably Isaiah Morton, one of the militiamen from Granite Falls. There was a scuffling noise among the mounted men, startled shouts, and then all hell broke loose as both guns went off. Horses reared and bolted, men bellowed and swore, and drifts of acrid white smoke fumed from the window. Roger had thrown himself flat at the first explosion. As the echoes died away, though, he scrambled up as though by reflex, flung mud out of his eyes, and charged the door head first. To his detached surprise, his mind was working very clearly. Brianna took 20 seconds to load and prime a gun, and he doubted that these buggers were much faster. He thought he had just about 10 seconds grace left, and he meant to use them. He hit the door with his shoulder, and it flew inward, smashing against the wall inside and causing Roger to rush staggering into the room and to crash into the wall on the opposite side. He struck his shoulder a numbing blow on the chimney piece, bounced off, and managed somehow to keep his feet, stumbling like a drunkard. Several people in the room had turned to gape at him. His vision cleared enough to see that only two of them were, in fact, holding guns. He took a deep breath, lunged for the nearest of these, a scrawny man with a straggling beard, and seized him by the shirt front, in imitation of a particularly fearsome third-form master at Roger's Grammar School.
"What do you think you're doing, you wee man, you?" he roared, jerking the man up onto his toes.
Mr. Sanderson would have been pleased, he supposed, at the thought that his example had been so memorable. Effective, too. While the scrawny man in Roger's grip didn't either wet himself or snivel, as the first-form students occasionally had under such treatment, he did make small gobbling sounds, pawing ineffectually at Roger's hand clutching his shirt.
"You, sir, leave hold of my brother!"
Roger's victim had dropped both his gun and powder horn when seized, spilling black powder all over the floor. The other gunman had succeeded in reloading his weapon, though, and was now endeavouring to bring it to bear on Roger. He was somewhat impeded in this attempt by the three women in the room, two of whom were blethering and pulling at his gun, getting in his way. The third had flung her apron over her head and was uttering loud, rhythmic shrieks of hysteria. At this point, Fergus strolled into the house, an enormous horse pistol in his hand. He pointed this negligently at the man with the gun.
"Be so kind as to put that down, if you will," he said, raising his voice to be heard above the racket. "And perhaps, madame, you could pour some water upon this young woman, or slap her briskly."
He gestured toward the screaming woman with his hook, wincing slightly at the noise. Moving as though hypnotized, one of the women went slowly toward the screeching girl, shook her roughly by the shoulder, and began to murmur in the girl's ear, not taking her eyes off Fergus. The shrieking stopped, replaced by irregular gulps and sobs. Roger felt an immense relief. Sheer rage, simple panic, and the absolute necessity of doing something had got him this far. But he would freely admit that he hadn't the slightest idea what to do next. He took a deep breath, feeling his legs begin to tremble, and slowly lowered his victim, releasing his grip with an awkward nod. The man took several fast steps backward, then stood brushing at the creases in his shirt, narrowed eyes fixed on Roger in resentment.
"And who in blazes are you?"
The second man, who had indeed put his weapon down, looked at Fergus in confusion. The Frenchman waved his hook, which, Roger noticed, seemed to fascinate the women, in a gesture of dismissal.
"That is of no importance," he said grandly, lifting his aristocratically prominent nose another inch. "I require, that is, we require," he amended with a polite nod toward Roger, "to know who you are."
The inhabitants of the cabin all exchanged confused looks, as though wondering who they might in fact be. After a moment's hesitation, though, the larger of the two men thrust out his chin pugnaciously.
"My name is Brown, sir. Richard Brown. This is my brother Lionel, my wife Meg, my daughter Alicia."
That appeared to be the girl in the apron, who had now removed the garment from her head and stood tear-stained and gulping.
"And my sister, Thomasina."
"Your servant, madame, mademoiselle."
Fergus made the ladies an extremely elegant bow, though taking good care to keep his pistol aimed at Richard Brown's forehead.
"My apologies for the disturbance."
Mrs. Brown nodded back, looking a little glazed. Miss Thomasina Brown, a tall, severe-looking person, looked from Roger to Fergus and back again with the expression of one comparing a cockroach and a centipede, deciding which to step on first. Fergus, having managed to transform the atmosphere from an armed confrontation to that of a Parisian salon, looked pleased. He glanced at Roger and inclined his head, clearly handing management of the situation over to him.
"Right."
Roger was wearing a loose woolen hunting shirt, but he felt as though it were a straitjacket. He took another deep breath, trying to force air into his chest.
"Well, as I said, I am Captain Mackenzie. We are charged by Governor Tryon with raising a militia company, and have come to notify you of your obligation to provide men and supplies."
Richard Brown looked surprised at this. His brother glowered. Before they could offer objections, though, Fergus moved closer to Roger, murmuring,
"Perhaps we should discover whether they have killed Mr. Morton, mon capitaine, before we accept them into our company."
"Oh.
Roger fixed the Browns with as stern an expression as possible.
"Mr. Fraser, will you see about Mr. Morton? I will remain here."
Keeping the Browns in his gaze, he held out a hand for Fergus's pistol.
"Oh, yon Morton still can't he, Captain. He isn't we asked for by, because he's taken to the bush like a wee bit moggy wi' a scorched tail, but he was moving his limbs when I saw him last."
A nasal Glaswegian voice spoke from the doorway, and Roger glanced over to see a cluster of interested heads peering into the cabin, Henry Gallagher's bristly knob among them. A number of drawn guns were also in evidence, and Roger's breath came a little easier. The Browns had lost interest in Roger and were staring at Gallagher in sheer bewilderment.
"What did he say?" Mrs. Brown whispered to her sister-in-law.
The older lady shook her head, lips drawn in like a purse string.
"Mr. Morton is alive and well," Roger translated for them.
He coughed.
"Fortunately for you,"
he said to the male Browns with as much menace as he could contrive to put into his voice. He turned to Gallagher, who had now come into the room and was leaning against the door jamb, musket in hand and looking distinctly entertained.
"Is everyone else all right then, Henry?"
Gallagher shrugged.
"They crap bags haven't hold anyone, but they gied your saddlebag rare, Laldy, wi' a load of bird shot. Sir,"
he added as an afterthought, teeth showing in a brief flash through his beard.
"The bag with the whisky?" Roger demanded.
"Get a war!"
Gallagher bugged his eyes in horror, then grinned in reassurance.
"Nah, t'other."
"Och, well," Roger waved a hand dismissively.
"That's only my spare breeks, isn't it?"
This philosophical response drew laughter and hoots of support from the men crammed in the doorway, which heartened Roger enough to round on the smaller Brown.
"And what do you have against Isaiah Morton?" he demanded.
"He's dishonoured my daughter,"
Mr. Brown replied promptly, having recovered his composure.
He glared at Roger, beard twitching with anger. "I told him I'd see him dead at her feet if he ever dared show his wretched countenance within 10 miles of Brownsville. And damn my eyes, if the grass-livered spittle-snake hasn't the face to ride right up to my door."
Mr. Richard Brown turned to Gallagher.
"You mean to tell me we both miss the bastard?"
Gallagher shrugged apologetically.
"Aye, sorry."
The younger Miss Brown had been following this exchange, mouth hanging slightly open.
"They missed?"
she asked, hope lighting her reddened eyes.
"Isaiah still alive?"
"Not for long,"
her uncle assured her grimly. He reached down to pick up his fowling piece, and all the female Browns burst out in a chorus of renewed screeches as the guns of the militia at the door all raised simultaneously, trained on Brown. He very slowly put the gun back down. Roger glanced at Fergus, who lifted one brow and gave the slightest of shrugs.
"Up to him."
The Browns had drawn together, the two brothers glaring at him, the women huddled behind them, sniffling and murmuring. Militiamen poked their heads curiously through the windows, all staring at Roger, waiting for direction. And just what was he to tell them? Morton was a member of the militia, and therefore, he assumed, entitled to its protection. Roger couldn't very well turn him over to the Browns, no matter what he'd done, always assuming he could be caught. On the other hand, Roger was charged with enlisting the Browns and the rest of the able-bodied men in Brownsville, and extracting at least a week's supplies from them as well. They didn't look as though such a suggestion would be well received at this point. He had the galling conviction that Jamie Fraser would have known immediately how best to resolve this diplomatic crisis. He, personally, hadn't a clue. He did at least have a delaying tactic. Sighing, he lowered the pistol and reached for the pouch at his waist.
"Henry, fetch in the saddlebag with the whisky, aye? And, Mr. Brown, perhaps you will allow me to purchase some food and a barrel of your beer for my men's refreshment?"
And with luck, by the time it was all drunk, Jamie Fraser would be here. Chapter 29. 1/3 of a goat. It wasn't quite over, after all. It was well past dark by the time we had finished everything at the Beardsley farm, tidied up, repacked the bags, and resaddled the horses. I thought of suggesting that we eat before leaving. We had had nothing since breakfast, but the atmosphere of the place was so disturbing that neither Jamie nor I had any appetite.
"We'll wait," he said, heaving the saddlebags over the mare's back.
He glanced over his shoulder at the house.
"I'm hollow as a gourd, but I couldn't have stomach a bite within sight of this place."
"I know what you mean." I glanced back, too, uneasily, though there was nothing to see. The house stood still and empty. I can't wait to get away from here. The sun had sunk below the trees, and a chill blue shadow spread across the hollow where the farmhouse stood. The raw earth of Beardsley's grave showed dark with moisture, a humped mound beneath the bare branches of the mountain ash. It was impossible to look at it without thinking of the weight of wet earth and immobility, of corruption and decay.
"You will rot and die,"
Jamie had said to him. I hoped the reversal of those two events had been of some benefit to Beardsley. It hadn't, to me. I hugged my shawl tight around my shoulders and breathed out hard, then deeply in, hoping the cold, clean scent of the pines would eradicate the phantom reek of dead flesh that seemed to cling to hands and clothes and nose. The horses were shifting, stamping and shaking their manes, eager to be off. I didn't blame them. Unable to stop myself, I looked back once more. A more desolate sight would be hard to imagine. Even harder to imagine was the thought of staying here, alone. Evidently Mrs. Beardsley had imagined it, and come to similar conclusions. At this point she emerged from the barn, the kid in her arms, and announced that she was coming with us. So evidently were the goats. She handed me the kid and disappeared back into the barn. The kid was heavy and half asleep, flexible little joints folded up into a cosy bundle. It huffed warm air over my hand, nibbling gently to see what I was made of, then made a small meh of contentment and relaxed into peaceful inertness against my ribs. A louder meh and a nudge at my thigh announced the presence of the kid's mother, keeping a watchful eye on her offspring. "Well, she can't very well leave them here," I muttered to Jamie, who was making disgruntled noises in the dusk behind me. "They have to be milked. Besides, it's not a terribly long way, is it?"
"Do you ken how fast a goat walks, Sassenach?"
"I've never had occasion to time one," I said rather testily, shifting my small hairy burden. "But I shouldn't think they'd be a lot slower than the horses, in the dark." He made a guttural Scottish noise at that, rendered more expressive even than usual by the phlegm in his throat. He coughed. "You sound awful," I said. "When we get where we're going, I'm taking the mentholated goose grease to you, my lad." He made no objection to this proposal, which rather alarmed me, as indicating a serious depression of his vitality. Before I could inquire further into his state of health, though, I was interrupted by the emergence from the barn of Mrs. Beardsley, leading six goats, roped together like a gang of jovially inebriate convicts. Jamie viewed the procession dubiously, sighed in resignation, and turned to a consideration of the logistical problems at hand. There was no question of mounting Mrs. Beardsley on Gideon the Man-eater. Jamie glanced from me to Mrs. Beardsley's substantial figure, then at the small form of my mare, little bigger than a pony, and coughed. After a bit of contemplation, he had Mrs. Beardsley mounted on Mrs. Piggy, the sleepy kid balanced before her. I would ride with him on Gideon's withers, theoretically preventing any attempt on that animal's part to fling me off his hindquarters into the underbrush. He tied a rope round the billy goat's neck and affixed this loosely to the mare's saddle, but left the nannies loose.
"The mother will stay with the kid, and the others will follow the billy here," he told me. "Goats are sociable creatures. They'll no be wanting to stray away by themselves, especially not at night." "Shoo," he muttered, pushing an inquisitive nose out of his face as he squatted to check the saddle girth. "I suppose pigs would be worse. They will gang their own way."
He stood up, absently patting a hairy head.
"If anything should come amiss, pull it loose at once," he told Mrs. Beardsley, showing her the half-bow loop tied to the saddle near her hand. "If the horse should run away with you all, your wee fellow there will be hanged."
She nodded, a hunched mound atop the horse, then lifted her head and looked toward the house.
"We should go before moonrise," she said softly. "She comes out then."
An icy ripple ran straight up my spine, and Jamie jerked, head snapping round to look at the darkened house. The fire had gone out, and no one had thought to close the open door. It gaped like an empty eye socket.
"She who?"
Jamie asked, a noticeable edge in his voice.
"Mary Ann," Mrs. Beardsley answered. "She was the last one."
There was no emphasis whatever in her voice. She sounded like a sleepwalker.
"The last what?" I asked.
"The last wife,"
she replied, and picked up her reins.
"She stands under the rowan tree at moonrise."
Jamie's head turned toward me. It was too dark to see his expression, but I didn't need to. I cleared my throat.
"Ought we to close the door?"
I suggested. Mr. Beardsley's spirit had presumably got the idea by now, and whether or not Mrs. Beardsley had any interest in the house and its contents, it didn't seem right to leave it at the mercy of marauding raccoons and squirrels, to say nothing of anything larger that might be attracted by the scent of Mr. Beardsley's final exit. On the other hand, I really had no desire at all to approach the empty house.
Get on the horse, Sassenach.
Jamie strode across the yard, slammed the door somewhat harder than necessary, then came back, walking briskly, and swung into the saddle behind me.
Hup,
he said sharply, and we were off, the glow of a rising half-moon just visible above the trees. It was perhaps a quarter mile to the head of the trail, the ground rising from the hollow in which the Beardsley's farmhouse stood. We were moving slowly because of the goats, and I watched the grass and shrubs as we brushed through them, wondering whether they seemed more visible only because my eyes were adapting to the dark, or because the moon had risen. I felt quite safe with the powerful bulk of the horse under me, the sociable natter of the goats around us, and Jamie's equally reassuring presence behind me, one arm clasped about my waist. I wasn't sure that I felt quite safe enough to turn and look back again, though. At the same time, the urge to look was so compelling as almost to counter the sense of dread I felt about the place. Almost.
It's no really a rowan tree, is it?
Jamie's voice came softly from behind me. No, I said, taking heart from the solid arm around me. It's a mountain ash. Very like, though. I'd seen mountain ash many times before. The Highlanders often planted them near cabins or houses because the clusters of deep orange berries and the pinnate leaves did indeed look like the rowan tree of Scotland, a close botanical relative. I gathered that Jamie's comment stemmed not from taxonomic hair-splitting, though, but rather from doubt as to whether the ash possessed the same repellent qualities in terms of protection from evil and enchantment. He hadn't chosen to bury Beardsley under that tree from a sense either of aesthetics or convenience. I squeezed his blistered hand, and he kissed me gently on top of the head. At the head of the trail I did glance back, but I could see nothing but a faint gleam from the weathered shingles of the farmhouse. The mountain ash, and whatever might or might not be under it, were hidden in darkness. Gideon was unusually well behaved, having made no more than a token protest at being double-mounted. I rather thought he was happy to leave the farm behind, too. I said as much. But Jamie sneezed and expressed the opinion that the wicked sod was merely biding his time while planning some future outrage. The goats seemed inclined to view this nocturnal excursion as a lark, and ambled along with the liveliest interest, snatching mouthfuls of dry grass, bumping into one another and the horses, and generally sounding like a herd of elephants in the crackling underbrush. I felt great relief at leaving the Beardsley place at last. As the pines blotted out the hollow, I resolutely turned my mind from the disturbing events of the day and began to think what might await us in Brownsville. "I hope Roger's managed all right," I said, leaning back against Jamie's chest with a small sigh.
"Mm-hmm. From long experience, I diagnosed this particularly catarrhal noise as indicating a polite general agreement with my sentiment, this overlaying complete personal indifference to the actuality." Either he saw no reason for concern, or he thought Roger could sink or swim.
"I hope he's found an inn of sorts," I offered, thinking this prospect might meet with a trifle more enthusiasm. "Hot food and a clean bed would be lovely."
"Mm-hmm."
That one held a touch of humour, mingled with an inborn scepticism, fostered by long experience regarding the possible existence of such items as hot food and clean beds in the Carolina backcountry. "The goats seem to be going along very well," I offered, and waited in anticipation.
"Mm-hmm." Grudging agreement mingled with a deep suspicion as to the continuance of good behaviour on the part of the goats.
I was carefully formulating another observation, in hopes of getting him to do it again. 3 times was the record so far, when Gideon suddenly bore out Jamie's original mistrust by flinging up his head with a loud snort and rearing. I crashed back into Jamie's chest, hitting my head on his collarbone with a thump that made me see stars. His arm crushed the air out of me as he dragged at the reins one-handed, shouting. I had no idea what he was saying, or even whether he was shouting in English or Gaelic. The horse was screaming, rearing, and pawing with his hoofs, and I was scrabbling for a grip on anything at all, mane, saddle, reins. A branch whipped my face and blinded me. Pandemonium reigned. There was screeching and bleating and a noise like tearing fabric, and then something hit me hard and sent me flying into the darkness. I wasn't knocked out, but it didn't make much difference. I was sprawled in a tangle of brush, struggling for breath, unable to move, and unable to see anything whatever beyond a few scattered stars in the sky overhead. There was an ungodly racket going on some little distance away, in which a chorus of panicked goats figured largely, punctuated by what I took to be a woman's screams. Two women's screams. I shook my head, confused. Then I flung myself over and started crawling, having belatedly recognised what was making that noise. I had heard panthers scream often enough, but always safely far in the distance. This one wasn't far away at all. The tearing fabric noise I'd heard had been the cough of a big cat, very close at hand. I bumped into a large fallen log and promptly rolled under it, wedging myself as far into the small crevice there as possible. It wasn't the best hiding place I'd ever seen, but might at least prevent anything leaping out of a tree onto me. I could still hear Jamie shouting, though the tenor of his remarks had changed to a sort of hoarse fury. The goats had mostly quit yammering. Surely the cat couldn't have killed all of them. I couldn't hear anything of Mrs. Beardsley either, but the horses were making a dreadful fuss, squealing and stamping. My heart was hammering against the leafy ground, and a cold sweat tingled along my jaw. There isn't much for invoking raw terror like the primitive fear of being eaten, and my sympathies were entirely with the animals. There was a crashing in the brush near at hand, and Jamie shouting my name. "Here?" I croaked, unwilling to move out of my refuge until I knew for certain where the panther was, or at least knew for certain that it wasn't anywhere near me. The horses had stopped squealing, though they were still snorting and stamping, making enough noise to indicate that neither of them had either fallen prey to our visitor or run away. "Here," I called, a little louder. More crashing, close at hand. Jamie stumbled through the darkness, crouched and felt under the log until his hand encountered my arm, which he seized. "Are you all right, Sassenach?"
"I hadn't thought to notice, but I think so," I replied.
I slid cautiously out from under my log, taking stock. Bruises here and there, abraded elbows, and a stinging sensation where the branch had slapped my cheek. "Basically, all right, then."
"Good. Come quick, he's hurt."
He hauled me to my feet and started propelling me through the dark with a hand in the small of my back.
"Who?" "The goat, of course."
My eyes were well adapted to the dark by now, and I made out the large shapes of Gideon and the mare standing under a leafless poplar, manes and tails swishing with agitation. A smaller shape that I took to be Mrs. Beardsley was crouched nearby over something on the ground. I could smell blood and a powerful reek of goat. I squatted and reached out, touching rough, warm hair. The goat jerked at my touch with a loud meh meh that reassured me somewhat. He might be hurt, but he wasn't dying, at least not yet. The body under my hands was solid and vital, muscles tense. "Where's the cat?" I asked, locating the ridged hardness of the horns and feeling my way hastily backward along the spine, then down the ribs and flanks. The goat had objections and heaved wildly under my hands.
"Gone," Jamie said.
He crouched down too and put a hand on the goat's head.
"There now, Avalach. It's all right then, Shes Mokarat."
I could feel no open wound on the goat's body, but I could certainly smell blood, a hot, metallic scent that disturbed the clean night air of the wood. The horses did too. They whickered and moved uneasily in the dark.
"Are we fairly sure it's gone?" I asked, trying to ignore the sensation of eyes fastened on the back of my neck.
I smell blood.
Aye, the cat took one of the nannies, Jamie informed me. He knelt next to me, laying a big hand on the goat's neck. Mrs. Beardsley loosed this brave laddie, and he went for the cat, bald-headed. A goodness he it all, but I think the creature maybe slapped at him. I heard it screech and spit, and the billy gave a skellach just then, too. I think his leg is maybe broken.
It was. With that guidance, I found the break easily, low on the humerus of the right front leg. The skin wasn't broken, but the bone was cracked through. I could feel the slight displacement of the raw ends.
The goat heaved and thrust his horns at my arm when I touched the leg.
His eyes were wild and rolling, the odd square pupils visible but colourless in the faint moonlight.
"Can you mend him, Sassenach?"
Jamie asked.
"I don't know."
The goat was still struggling, but the flurries of movement were growing perceptibly weaker as shock set in. I bit my lip, groping for a pulse in the fold between leg and body. The injury itself was likely repairable, but shock was a great danger. I'd seen plenty of animals, and a few people for that matter, die quickly following a traumatic incident, of injuries that were not fatal in themselves.
"I don't know," I said again.
My fingers had found a pulse at last. It was trip-hammer fast and thready. I was trying to envision the possibilities for treatment, all of them crude. "He may well die, Jamie, even if I can set the leg. Do you think perhaps we ought to slaughter him? He'd be a lot easier to carry as meat." Jamie stroked the goat's neck gently.
"It would be a great shame on him, such a gallant creature."
Mrs. Beardsley laughed at that, a nervous, small giggle, like a girl's, coming out of the dark beyond Jamie's bulk.
"His name is Hiram," she said. "He's a good boy."
"Hiram," Jamie repeated, still stroking. "Well then, Hiram. Courage, mon brave. You'll do. You've balls as big as melons."
"Well, persimmons, maybe," I said, having inadvertently encountered the testicles in question while making my examination. "Perfectly respectable, though, I'm sure," I added, taking shallow breaths. "Hiram's musk glands were working overtime. Even the harsh iron smell of blood took second place."
"I was speaking figuratively," Jamie informed me rather dryly. "What will you be needing, Sassenach?"
Evidently the decision had been made. He was already rising to his feet. "Right then," I said, brushing back my hair with the back of a wrist. "Find me a couple of straight branches, about a foot long, no twigs, and a bit of rope from the saddlebags. Then you can help here," I added, trying to achieve a good grip on my struggling patient.
"Hiram seems to like you. Recognises a kindred spirit, no doubt." Jamie laughed at that, a low, comforting sound at my elbow. He stood up with a final scratch of Hiram's ears and rustled off, coming back within moments with the requested items. "Right," I said, loosing one hand from Hiram's neck in order to locate the sticks. "I'm going to splint it. We'll have to carry him, but the splint will keep the leg from flexing and doing any more damage. Help me get him onto his side." Hiram, whether from male pride or goat stubbornness, always assuming these to be different things, kept trying to stand up, broken leg notwithstanding. His head was bobbing alarmingly, though, as the muscles in his neck weakened and his body lurched from side to side. He scrabbled feebly at the ground, then stopped, panting heavily. Mrs. Beardsley hovered over my shoulder, the kid still clutched in her arms. It gave a faint bleat, as though it had awakened suddenly from a nightmare, and Hiram gave a loud, echoing "meh" in reply.
"There's a thought," Jamie murmured.
He stood up suddenly and took the kid from Mrs. Beardsley. Then he knelt down again, pushing the little creature up close to Hiram's side. The goat at once ceased struggling, bending his head around to sniff at his offspring. The kid cried, pushing its nose against the big goat's side, and a long, slimy tongue snaked out, slobbering over my hand as it sought the kid's head.
"Work fast, Sassenach," Jamie suggested.
I needed no prompting, and within minutes had the leg stabilised, the splinting padded with one of the multiple shawls Mrs. Beardsley appeared to be wearing. Hiram had settled, making only occasional grunts and exclamations, but the kid was still bleating loudly.
"Where is its mother?"
I asked, though I didn't need to hear the answer. I didn't know a great deal about goats, but I knew enough about mothers and babies to realize that nothing but death would keep a mother from a child making that sort of racket. The other goats had come back, drawn by curiosity, fear of the dark, or a simple desire for company. But the mother didn't push forward.
"Poor Becky," said Mrs. Beardsley sadly. "Such a sweet goat."
Dark forms bumped and jostled. There was a whiff of hot air in my ears, one nibbled at my hair, and another stepped on my calf, making me yelp as the sharp little hooves scraped the skin. I made no effort to shoo them away, though. The presence of his harem seemed to be doing Hiram the world of good. I had the leg bones back in place and the splint bandaged firmly round them. I had found a good pulse point at the base of his ear and was monitoring it, Hiram's head resting in my lap. As the other goats pressed in, nuzzling at him and making plaintive noises, he suddenly lifted his head and rolled up onto his chest, the broken leg awkwardly stuck out before him in its bindings. He swayed to and fro like a drunken man for a moment, then uttered a loud, belligerent "meh" and lurched onto 3 feet. He promptly fell down again, but the action cheered everyone. Even Mrs. Beardsley emitted a faint trill of pleasure at the sight.
"All right."
Jamie stood up and ran his fingers through his hair with a deep sigh.
"Now then."
"Now then what?"
I asked.
"Now I shall decide what to do," he said, with a certain edge to his voice.
"Aren't we going on to Brownsville?"
"We might," he said, "if Mrs. Beardsley happens to ken the way well enough to find the trail again by starlight."
He turned expectantly toward her, but I could see the negative motion of her head, even in the shadows. It dawned on me that we were, in fact, no longer on the trail, which was in any case no more than a narrow deer track winding through the forest.
"We can't be terribly far off, surely?"
I looked round, peering vainly into the dark, as though some lighted sign might indicate the position of the trail. In fact, I had no idea even in which direction it might lie.
"No," Jamie agreed. "And by myself, I dare say I could pick it up sooner or later. But I didn't mean to go floundering through the forest in the dark with this lot."
He glanced round, evidently counting noses. 2 very skittish horses, 2 women, one distinctly odd and possibly homicidal, and 6 goats, 2 of them incapable of walking. I rather saw his point.
He drew his shoulders back, shrugging a little, as though to ease a tight shirt. "I'll go and have a keek round. If I find the way at once, well and good. If I don't, we'll camp for the night," he said. "It will be a deal easier to look for the trail by daylight. Be careful, Sassenach."
And with a final sneeze, he vanished into the woods, leaving me in charge of the camp followers and wounded. The orphan goat was becoming louder and more anguished in its cries. It hurt my ears as well as my heart. Mrs. Beardsley, though, had become somewhat more animated in Jamie's absence. I thought she was rather afraid of him. Now she brought up one of the other nannies, persuading her to stand still for the orphan to suckle. The kid was reluctant for a moment, but hunger and the need for warmth and reassurance were overwhelming, and within a few minutes it was feeding busily, its small tail wagging in a dark flicker of movement. I was happy to see it, but conscious of a small feeling of envy. I was all at once aware that I had eaten nothing all day, that I was very cold, desperately tired, sore in a number of places, and that without the complications of Mrs. Beardsley and her companions, I would long since have been safely in Brownsville, fed, warm, and tucked up by some friendly fireside. I put a hand on the kid's stomach, growing round and firm with milk, and thought rather wistfully that I should like someone simply to take care of me. Still, for the moment, I seemed to be the good shepherd, and no help for it.
"Do you think it might come back?"
Mrs. Beardsley crouched next to me, shawl pulled tight around her broad shoulders. She spoke in a low tone, as though afraid someone might overhear.
"What? The panther?"
"No, I don't think so. Why should it?" Nonetheless, a small shiver ran over me as I thought of Jamie alone somewhere in the dark. Hiram, his shoulder firmly jammed against my thigh, snorted, then laid his head on my knee with a long sigh.
"Them folk say the cats hunt in pairs."
"Really?"
I stifled a yawn, not of boredom, simply fatigue. I blinked into the darkness, a chilled lethargy stealing over me. "Oh, well, I should think a good-sized goat would do for two.
Besides,"
I yawned again, a jaw-cracking stretch.
"Besides, the horses would let us know."
Gideon and Mrs. Piggy were companionably nose and tailing it under the poplar tree, showing no signs now of agitation. This seemed to comfort Mrs. Beardsley, who sat down on the ground quite suddenly, her shoulders sagging as though the air had gone out of her.
"And how are you feeling?" I inquired,
more from an urge to maintain a conversation than from any real desire to know.
"I'm glad to be gone from that place," she said simply.
I definitely shared that sentiment. Our present situation was at least an improvement on the Beardsley homestead, even with the odd panther thrown in. Still, that didn't mean I was anxious to spend very long here.
"Do you know anyone in Brownsville?" I asked. I wasn't sure how large a settlement it was, though from the conversation of some of the men we had picked up, it sounded like a fair-sized village.
"No."
She was silent for a moment, and I felt, rather than saw, her tilt back her head, looking up at the stars and the peaceful moon.
"I have never been to Brownsville," she added almost shyly.
Or anywhere else, it seemed. She told the story hesitantly, but almost eagerly, with no more than slight prodding on my part. Beardsley had, in essence, bought her from her father, and brought her, with other goods acquired in Baltimore, down to his house, where he had essentially kept her prisoner, forbidding her to leave the homestead or to show herself to anyone who might come to the house. Left to do the work of the homestead while Beardsley travelled into the Cherokee lands with his trade goods, she had had no society but a bond lad, who was little company, being deaf and speechless.
"Really?" I said.
In the events of the day, I had quite forgotten Josiah and his twin. I wondered whether she had known both of them, or only Keziah.
"How long is it since you came to North Carolina?" I asked.
2 years, she said softly. 2 years, 3 months, and 5 days.
I remembered the marks on the doorpost, and wondered when she'd begun to keep count.
From the very beginning.
I stretched my back, disturbing Hiram, who grumbled.
"I see. By the way, what is your Christian name?"
I asked, belatedly aware that I had no idea.
"Francis," she said.
Then tried again, not liking the mumbled sound of it.
"Francis."
The end of it a hiss through her broken teeth. She gave a shrug then and laughed, a small, shy sound.
"Fanny," she said. "My mother called me Fanny."
"Fanny," I said encouragingly.
"That's a very nice name. May I call you so?" "I would be pleased," she said.
She drew breath again, but stopped without speaking, evidently too shy to say whatever she'd had in mind. With her husband dead, she seemed entirely passive, quite deprived of the force that had animated her earlier.
"Oh,"
I said, belatedly realizing, "Claire. Do call me Claire, please."
"Claire. How pretty."
"Well, it hasn't any S's, at least," I said, not thinking.
"Oh,
I do beg your pardon." She made a small pff sound of dismissal. Encouraged by the dark, the faint sense of intimacy engendered by the exchange of names, or simply from a need to talk after so long, she told me about her mother, who had died when she was 12, her father, a crabber, and her life in Baltimore, wading out along the shore at low tide to rake oysters and gather mussels, watching the fishing craft and the warships come in past Fort Howard to sail up the Patapsco.
It was peaceful, she said,
rather wistfully.
It was so open, nothing but the sky and the water.
She tilted back her head again, as though yearning for the small bit of night sky visible through the interlacing branches overhead. I suppose the wilder forested mountains of North Carolina were refuge and embrace to a Highlander like Jamie. They might well seem claustrophobic and alien to someone accustomed to the watery Chesapeake shore.
"Will you go back there, do you think?" I asked.
"Back?" She sounded slightly startled.
"Oh, I hadn't thought."
"No?" I had found a tree trunk to lean against and stretch slightly to ease my back.
"You must have seen that that Mr. Beardsley was dying. Didn't you have some plan? Beyond the fun of torturing him slowly to death, that is."
It occurred to me that I'd been getting altogether too comfortable with this woman, alone in the dark with the goats. She might truly have been Beardsley's victim, or she might only be saying so now to enlist our aid. It would behoove me to remember the burned toes on Beardsley's foot and the appalling state of that loft. I straightened up a little and felt for the small knife I carried at my belt, just in case.
"No."
She sounded a little dazed, and no wonder, I supposed. I felt more than a little dazed myself, simply from emotion and fatigue. Enough so that I almost missed what she said next.
"What did you say?"
"I said, Mary Ann didn't tell me what I was to do after."
"Mary Ann?"
I said cautiously. "Yes, and that would be the first Mrs. Beardsley, would it?" She laughed, and the hair on my neck rippled unpleasantly.
"Oh, no. Mary Ann was the fourth one."
"The fourth one?" I said, a little faintly.
"That's the only one he buried under the rowan tree," she informed me. "That was a mistake. The others are in the woods. He got lazy, I think. He didn't want to walk so far."
"Oh," I said, for lack of any better response.
"I told you. She stands under the rowan tree at moonrise. When I saw her there at first, I thought she was a living woman. I was afraid of what he might do if he saw her there alone, so I stole from the house to warn her."
"I see." Something in my voice must have sounded less than credulous, for her head turned sharply toward me. I took a firmer grip on the knife.
"You do not believe me?"
"Of course I do," I assured her, trying to edge Hiram's head off my lap. My left leg had gone to sleep from the pressure of his weight, and I had no feeling in my foot.
"I can show you," she said,
and her voice was calm and certain.
"Mary Ann told me where they were, the others, and I found them. I can show you their graves."
"I'm sure that won't be necessary," I said, flexing my toes to restore circulation. If she came toward me, I decided, I would shove the goat into her path, roll to the side, and make off as fast as possible on all fours, shouting for Jamie. And where in bloody hell was Jamie, anyway?
"So, Fanny,
you're saying that Mr. Beardsley..." It occurred to me that I didn't know his name either, but I thought I would just as soon keep my relations with his memory formal under the circumstances. "That your husband murdered four wives?
And no one knew?"
Not that anyone necessarily would know, I realised. The Beardsley homestead was very isolated, and it wasn't at all unusual for women to die of accident, childbirth, or simple overwork. Someone might have known that Beardsley had lost four wives, but it was entirely possible that no one cared how.
"Yes."
She sounded calm, I thought, not incipiently dangerous, at least. He would have killed me too, but Marianne stopped him. How did she do that?